Wholesaling Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. It's time for Darren, Donick, and Chase. With hosts Darren McFarland, Willie Donick, and Chase McCabe. On Nashville's best sports talk,
ESPN
102.5 The Game.
Fourth and final hour on this gorgeous Thursday afternoon here in Middle Tennessee. Darren, Donick, and Chase. Darren McFarland, Willie Donick, and Chase McCabe with you. We're down here in College Grove in Arrington, right off 840. We're at the Corn Ferry Tour, Simmons Bank Open for the Snedeker Foundation. Beautiful day here as these golfers. These are golfers that are striving to make the tour on a regular basis. And it's really cool, chasing their dreams. We've had a lot of fun doing this over the years. It's moved from the Nashville Golf and Athletic Club. They had the year off last year because of the pandemic, but back at it again, and they've changed locations. And, of course, the goal that we're being told is this to turn into an actual PGA Tour event here in our city. Nashville could certainly use that on the golf scene. Let's bring in Elliot Freeman from Sportsnet. 31 Thoughts, Hockey Night in Canada. He does it all. We haven't talked to him in a couple of weeks. Just so I have this straight, the information that we were told, you were running a marathon for charity last Thursday?
No, is that correct? No, that's not me. No, that was my coworker, Chris Johnston.
Oh. I heard the conversation.
Okay.
And if people haven't heard it, there's a great podcast that Elliot's a part of, the 31 Thoughts. And I heard your interview because it was the same episode that Roman Josi was on, so I wanted to make a point.
Yes.
Listen, so I heard Chris's story. Not only did you run a marathon, guys, but Elliot, tell people Chris Johnston, we've had on our show before.
Yep.
We've come through his circles before, but he runs every single day.
What?
Right? Every single day for how many straight days?
Well, he's over 365 now. And so basically Chris Johnston, who works with me at Sportsnet, my fellow insider, so last year at the end of April, which was about 6 or 7 weeks into COVID, he was, you know, a bit stressed out. So he said, you know what, I'm going to start running. And he ran every day. And on the 365th day, 1 year, he decided to do a marathon for a charity up here called Conquer COVID-19. It's basically a charity that donates to groups or individuals who've been hit hard financially by the pandemic. So he ran every day for a year. He didn't miss a day. Even on Christmas, he went out and he ran. And I went that morning to support him. I went when he left, and I was back in time for the finish. And I said to him, and we said on the podcast, are you going to run tomorrow? And he said, yes, I will. And first of all, he's stupid. And secondly,
like day after marathon, I don't think I'm running. Come on,
like stay in bed, Chris. But he's still doing it. Like so, he's like, I mean, geez, now he's got to be up around 370 days. Like he's got to be close to 380 days. Like it's crazy town. But like me, I Peloton guys for like 30 to 45 minutes at a time. Going out and running, that's not for me. Definitely not for me.
I'm trying to figure out in that span how many MRIs and knee surgeries I would have had by now. But
in Rocky, there's the guy who runs and there's the guy who drives the car pulling along the runner.
Sure,
I'm the car driver. That's me.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Were you doing the water station, or you know, I didn't know what your role was in this.
No, you know what? I like his wife was with him and his dad was with him, and also. The great thing about it was that he did a radio interview about it a few days in advance, and there's a guy in Toronto, he's a running coach, and he reached out to Chris and he says, you want some help? So this guy ran the last 20 kilometers with him to help Chris get through it. So I was just there for moral support. I was worried I'd be like the guy in Seinfeld who, like Kramer, who gives him coffee instead of water and he loses the marathon. So I was just there for moral support. I was like, I said, do you guys need anything? They said, no. I said, I'm going to stay out of the way and just be supportive because I didn't want to ruin anything.
The craziest marathon story we ever heard over the years, Elliot, is we used to do The Titans brought in an undrafted guy from UCLA by the name of Drew Bennett. He started off as a quarterback, switched over to wide receiver. And he was one of those camp stories, right, that the coaches were falling in love with. And he ends up making, you know, the team. And, of course, you know, the rest is history. He ended up signing a big deal and made a lot of money and had a productive NFL career as a receiver. And we ended up doing his player show for several years out at a big mall, Cool Springs Galleria, which is not far from where we are today. And we would do it in the food court. It was a huge hit. And he once told us a story that when he was at UCLA, him and his buddies, say, you know, I'm sure there was probably some partying going on. And they decided the night before, Elliot, you know what?
Let's do this.
No, not a 5K, not a half marathon. Yeah, let's do a marathon tomorrow. Let's literally just get up and go do it. 26.2 miles. And they did. Floyd Reese later told us, who was the general manager of the Titans at the time, he said he knew about that, and it was part of the intrigue. He was like, if this guy can just get up and run a marathon, like there's something there, right? There's something to him. He's got something special. Like, nobody does that. And he pulled it off. He did the full marathon.
That's awesome. That's a fantastic story. That's why I hate athletes, because they're just athletes, right? And we're not. Like, just hate them.
Right. Like, I would never, ever do that. But, yeah, you're right. That's why you're just so envious of that. So let's get into this craziness that's been the last 72 hours at Madison Square Garden and New York and the Rangers and the Capitals. Let's just start with just the obvious. What are your overall thoughts of what's transpired in this mess?
Well, just it's craziness. You know, I wrote this week I felt Wilson should have been suspended. You know, I worked with a couple of guys who did the enforcer role in the NHL. You know, they weren't as offensively gifted as Wilson, but they were talented players at a lower level who had to do that to survive in the NHL. And that was PJ Stock and Nick Kypreos. And, you know, one of the things I would hear them talk about was, and we've all seen it, when there's a fight and you realize your opponent is no longer fighting or they're hurt or they can't continue for whatever reason, and they stop. There's an honor in that. That's the way it's supposed to be. If your opponent's injured or doesn't really want to fight, you've got to stop. And, you know, Panarin was going there to defend his teammates, and he reached a point where he wasn't fighting Wilson. He was just trying to stop him. And I think it's on Wilson to recognize that and say, okay, this guy's not really fighting me. And I think he lost his temper because he was mad at a penalty he took early that period, which was a question, like some people thought it was a questionable call. And secondly, it was a line change on an icing and they forced him to get off the ice and he was mad. So I think he lost his temper, and I think it's on him in that moment to realize that he's got to control his temper, because the consequences were already bad. An $11 million player got hurt. You know, fortunately for him and the Rangers, A, it's not as serious as it could have been, and B, you know, they're done in two more games. But, you know, it could have been really bad. And it's bad for the league. It's bad for the brand if that happens. And, you know, like Tim Peel in what happened in your city, one of the reasons the league acted so quickly was because it was bad for the shield, to borrow an NFL phrase. Well, to me, that was bad for the shield. And I think Wilson should have been suspended. You know, last night, I thought there were two things kind of going on there. Number one, I thought that there was the reaction to the fact Wilson wasn't suspended, but I think it was also more than that. Like, the Rangers players basically got called out. They got called soft. They got called wimps. And I never judge anybody any way that I would judge, in any other way that I would judge myself, that I would judge myself. And I know that if I spent 2 days being called that, I would probably run through somebody too. I think it wasn't just about the non-suspension. I think it was about showing everybody and each other that they weren't soft. And in the postgame last night, Brendan Smith, the guy who fought Wilson, was asked specifically that, and he looked right at the Zoom camera and said, "Do you think I'm soft?" And the guy backed down. He said, "No, I probably would have too." But he, you know, I think it showed how sensitive they were to that. And, you know, today, the statement, that is unheard of in the NHL. It was a wild statement. And I got to tell you, like, there were people who thought it was going to be a lot more than $250,000. I had people who thought that the Rangers were going to fire, could get fined $1 million. Like, it was, I mean, this is a week that we don't see that often. That's for sure.
What is the fallout, or is there, from Peros? You know George Peros. I mean, look, there's going to be, when I say fallout, I'm saying he's going to be scrutinized even more. Like, now he is on, not that he wasn't on a radar, but he's on a different level of a radar. Like, everything is going to be scrutinized even more moving forward. So how do you think that's going to get handled? By the way, it's going to probably start with Buchnevich, right? What's going to happen? I guess he's going to get suspended. I'm assuming.
Wouldn't be surprised. I don't know this for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if he gets the last two games of the season. You know, there were people last night saying, well, you can't suspend him because he didn't suspend Wilson. I don't buy that. One thing is different than the other. You know, I mean, it was crazy last night. There's no question about that. It was absolutely a crazy sign, but... I think he gets it.
Well, how do you think Peros will navigate through these troubled waters? Because, you know, there's going to be a lot of people. And look, we recognize it's an extremely difficult job. It is. I don't know why anybody wants it. It's got to be.
Job in the league.
So, yes. But he is going to be under heavy scrutiny moving forward. I mean, no matter what. And he's probably going to be in a no-win in a lot of cases moving forward with a lot of fan bases and a lot of people. So how does he try to get through this, in your opinion, long term, or does he?
Well, I think there's a couple things here. Number one, you know, someone pointed out to me that if you wanted George Peros to be fired, you wouldn't do that statement because Bettman will never allow that to happen now. Like, because it's almost like if you back the commissioner into a corner, he's going to be like, or you tell him he has to do something, he's not going to do it. He'll get his back up and he'll fight his way out of it. That's kind of his way. I think the biggest thing, honestly, guys, is that I think people run out of steam in that job. You know, Brian Burke, he reached his limit. Colin Campbell, he reached his limit. Brendan Shanahan, he reached his limit. Stephane Quintal, like, he reached his limit. And now George Peros, you know, I could see him reaching his limit too. Like, it's a really hard job. There's nobody, if you're a GM of a team, you've got your team behind you, right? Like, you've got support. George Peros, he has the league behind him in a way, but also everybody is coming after you. Do this, do this, don't do this, don't do that. You can't do this, you can't do that. And almost everybody is mad at you or saying you're not doing enough most of the time. Like I said, I disagreed with this one. I thought it was the wrong call. But I do think most people get to a point in that job where they don't want to do it anymore. But, you know, we'll see. I think he'll suspend Buchnevich. That's my prediction. And then there'll be more fallout, and we'll see where we go from here.
Elliot Friedman is with us. Elliot, you just mentioned some of the names that have gone into that job and out over the years.
Yeah.
What's the consensus from the people you talk to? And you mentioned a couple that I would be curious their opinion. Like, how do you think George Peros has done in that position compared to his predecessors?
I think that, you know, the one thing I think the NHL does really well now is they've gone back in the last 20 years and they've basically said, okay, here's an incident, say a headshot. Here's all the times that people have been suspended for a headshot in the past and then they break it down by what happens on the headshot and how many games that person got. I think they're really good at identifying that. Like, if I ever send a note saying during a game and say, okay, like, give me some history, I get quick answers and a general idea of what has happened in the past. I think they're very good at that. My critique about that is that sometimes it means I think they're a little bit too rigid. And, you know, that's the way lawyers are. They always look at precedent. Okay, what's the past? What's happened? What is this? And they kind of stick around that. Now, this year, they broke that precedent once, and that was on Wilson's last suspension. He was suspended 7 games for hitting a player named Brendan Carlo for Boston, who just actually came back to action. He got a boarding suspension. He hit the guy, he hit Carlo from front to side. And there's never been a boarding suspension before for a player coming that way. It's only been hitting a guy from behind. But they were so determined that they had to suspend Wilson for that hit that they interpreted their rules differently. And some people really hated that, and some people really liked it, but they didn't. And I think this time they fell into the old trap of kind of being a bit too rigid. If you're going to reinterpret things a little bit last time, I felt they could have interpreted things a bit this time. That's my only critique. I think, you know, they do a much better job of indexing the past, but in this particular case, I think they stuck a bit too much with that past, and they could have interpreted things differently like they did last time.
Elliot, I think this is a tough question to answer, because why does Jim Dolan do anything that he does, especially if you have any following of the Knicks? But why do you think they fired the GM and the president with John Davidson? Because all of us jumped to the conclusion, well, I guess they crossed the line. I guess the ownership wasn't okay with the statement. But this one looks really complicated here.
Well, first of all, the statement had nothing to do with the general manager or the president. Like, Davidson and Gordon had nothing to do with that statement. That was right from the top. Right from the top. That was Dolan. And Dolan's had some battles with the NHL before. Like, a few years ago, there was a battle over the websites. The NHL wanted uniform websites for every team. So that, say, if you were a Predators fan and you wanted to go on the Dallas Stars website, you knew how to navigate. They all were the same. It was an easy navigation. Well, the Rangers wanted to do something different, and there was a battle with the league. And Dolan and the league haven't always seen eye to eye. So he did that on his own, and nobody was telling him no. This situation was not tied into all of that. It was simply about Dolan, and as you said, if you know anything about the Knicks, you know he's very impulsive. Like, this is a guy who in 2005 hired Larry Brown to a $60 million contract and fired him in a year. Now, they settled for 20, but that just shows you, you know, who he is. And I think he just felt the rebuild wasn't going fast enough. I think the Rangers have done a great job. I think they're building a really good team. He disagreed. And, you know, I thought it was really interesting today that Glenn Sather was back on the Zoom call with Chris Drury, who's the new president and GM. And Sather and James Dolan have kept a good relationship. And, you know, I think Sather was another person who felt that this should have moved faster.
Wow. Elliot, I want to ask you one quick one about your interview with Roman. I thought it was really insightful. And one thing that jumped out at me is him talking about some of the detail of the John Hines system. And I think all of us who have watched this year have come to admire and respect John Hines, because he took a lot of heat, right? He was the unknown. You line up his accolades compared to his predecessors, Peter Laviolette and Barry Trotz. You know, he doesn't have nearly the experience or the skins on the wall, but I thought it was great hearing Roman Josi talking about just the expertise of John Hines and bringing the team through the hardship they've had.
Well, I thought Josi was a really good guest too. I did have some people who said that it was a joke that I talked about the meditation with him, and I'm a big believer in that. And I said that the thing we have in common besides like amazingly good looks, and I had some people was like, that's embarrassing, you comparing yourself to him in that particular way. But I thought, I thought it was really interesting. Well, first of all, you make a good point about Hines. Like, in Nashville, you guys have a high expectation of your hockey coaches, which is legit. I mean, you've had a couple of great ones there. But I just thought it was interesting to hear him talk about that because, you know, teams that play against them, they basically tell their team that Yossi's a rover. And it's clear he thought that was a little much, but it shows you how much latitude he gets from Hines and the Nashville system. Like, the coaches say, one of the players was telling me, you have to be prepared for him to go anywhere and do anything. Like, you can't look for where you think a defenseman is supposed to be and he's going to be over there. No. The rules go out the window for him. And, you know, he says it's not quite like that. I do have freedom, but I recognize what the risks are, and I'm the one who has to figure what they should or shouldn't be. But, man, I mean, I also had teams tell me that since you guys have climbed off the mat, he's been even better this year than when he won the Norris Trophy last year. And it was interesting to hear him say that maybe it's been better now, but he thought he wasn't very good at the beginning of the year.
We're talking to Elliot Friedman of Sportsnet, our weekly chat with him. So May 15th, 9 days from now, is that when we could see the playoffs starting around the NHL, or at least on the U.S. side?
That's what it sounds like, next Saturday.
Does that fit kind of what you had in your mind with some of the hiccups that they had, you know, whether it was Dallas at the beginning of the year, even though looking like they're not going to be there, but with just the scheduling conflicts that they had to work through, does May 15th feel like that's a good date and that was right?
That it's about 4 or 5 days later than what we expected. I think, guys, there were times during the season where we wondered if it was going to be even later than that. Like this year, beggars can't be choosers. You just have to take what's given, and I think they definitely take it. You know, I think that the schedule was much more compressed than a lot of people would have liked it to be, but that's the world we're living in. And, you know, it sounds like a lot of the U.S. teams and players are vaccinated, or a good percentage of them are. So knock on wood, hopefully we get through this okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And the NHL and the teams deserve a lot of credit for being able to pull this off. As we inch closer and closer to the off season, and the Kraken mm-hmm. now officially a member of the NHL, they are a team. I noticed in your column of the, you know, they got to be around the $48.9 million under the salary cap. That's where they have to be at, and they would target the minimum. So what does that mean necessarily of just kind of what they're going to look like when they go through the expansion draft and be ready to start their first season?
Well, basically what happens is the salary cap for next year, I think, is $81.5 million, which is the same as it is now. And the expansion rules say that they have to draft at a minimum 60% of that. So that's $48.9 million. And some of the teams have told me that they think that what Seattle will do is considering doing, I should say, is targeting that minimum, which means they would still have more than $30 million of salary cap space to make their decisions and use as a weapon. So that way they could be active in free agency. That way they could still be active in trades to say to teams, okay, you need some cap space. How are you willing to incentivize us with picks or prospects or players to take that contract you need us to take? And so that's what I think that means. You know, they're going to drive a hard bargain. They're not going to make it easy on people.
Yeah, and I know I've asked you about You know, if the Predators, for instance, wanted to try and offload one of the big contracts, whether it's a Duchesne or a Johansson, or I'd even throw Ryan Ellis in there, you're saying you think it's going to take a lot for them to be able to do that.
I think they know that the price will be big, whether it's picks or prospects or players. Yes, it's going to cost them.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. Elliot, it's good to talk to you again. We appreciate the time as always, and we will do it again next week.
All right, guys. Have a great week.
Elliot Friedman, Sportsnet, NHL Insider, joins us every Thursday at 1 o'clock. We'll have much more coming here. And Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game.